Hello and welcome to the Sydney Institute podcast. The Institute is Australia's premier current affairs forum. Every week, contemporary political, social, cultural, and economic issues are explored at the Institute through dialogue and discussion. This podcast was recorded recently at a members' forum in the city of Sydney. Thanks for listening, and for more information about the Sydney Institute, please visit www.thesydneyinstitute.com.au. We hope you enjoy this event.
Many thanks for coming along tonight. John M. Green makes a welcome first appearance at the Sydney Institute. Many of you here know him well. He's been a lawyer, a partner in two legal firms. He was an executive director at the investment bank Macquarie Bank. He's also written for newspapers, and in the most recent dimension of the life of John M. Green, he's become a novelist with three novels: Nowhere Man, Born to Run, and lately The Trusted. But he's also co-founder of Pantera Press, and the word on the wires today is that Pantera Press has been shortlisted for the prestigious Australian Book Industry Awards as Small Publisher of the Year. And I'm sure it's just a matter of time before it becomes Big Publisher of the Year. Just a matter of time. Anyway, it's great to have John here tonight, and the topic for his talk is business and the cyber wars. John, you're very welcome. Thank you.
So thank you very much, ladies and gentlemen, for coming tonight and to the Sydney Institute for having me here. It's a great pleasure and a privilege for me. I should confess that I have a cold, so perhaps as well as talking about hacking, I may be doing some. So let me kick off with posing some scenarios for you. What if the phone in your pocket that Gerard asked you to turn off blew up in your pocket? What if the computers on your desks blew up, destroying all of your data? What if planes fell out of the sky? What if stock markets collapsed? What if our city's power network shut down? Yes, welcome to a thriller writer's fertile imagination. Or is it? Now, it's true that catastrophes like these are sprinkled through my book, The Trusted. But what I hope you'll take away from my talk tonight, apart from at least one of my novels, is that threats like these are no longer merely fanciful imaginations, and also that business is doing far too little to prevent them or be prepared for them. You're probably thinking I'm trying to boost my book sales. Well, I am, but I'm not being alarmist. If you don't believe me, listen to David Irvine, the Director General of ASIO. Wait, David, is that you up there in the back with the false nose and the trench coat? Oh, it's a real nose. I'm sorry, sir. When David Irvine gave an exclusive interview to the Financial Review in January, he made it very clear that while my premise in The Trusted may be fiction, it is certainly not fantasy, not anymore. This is what he told the AFR. Quote, "A single malicious algorithm could switch off our lights, stop all planes flying, disrupt whole countries' financial networks, or shut down their electricity grids." Unquote. He sounds remarkably like me, don't you think? The head of ASIO is saying, very deliberately, that the outrageous attacks that my bad guys, conspire to do in The Trusted can be done today. But I will go one step further and say that unless we're all more alert and prepared, especially in business, horrific things like this will happen, perhaps tomorrow. US Secretary of Defense Leon Panetta said it too. Quote, "A cyber attack perpetrated by violent extremists could be as destructive as September 11, a cyber Pearl Harbor." Likewise, the FBI's director, Robert Mueller, said, "In the not-too-distant future, the cyber threat will pose the greatest threat to our country." Now, poor Mr. Mueller. I'm guessing he feels especially vulnerable about cyber threats because recently his own personal credit details and social security number and those of other famous people, including Michelle Obama, were dumped on the web for all to see after three of the United States' top credit reporting agencies were hacked into. Even China, the country that many people swear on a stack of Confucius sayings is the world's most prolific cyber attacker, is worried about cyber war. 2 weeks ago, the chief of staff of China's People's Liberation Army, General Fang, yes, Fang, what a great name for a general, General Fang Fang Wei, said that cyber war's consequences may be as serious as a nuclear bomb. A few years ago, when the premise for the trust had first popped into my head, cyber war was not the hot topic that it is today. Like many of you, the businessman in me saw the twin forces of globalization and technology optimistically as lifting millions out of poverty and driving productivity and wealth creation. But the novelist in me asked, but what if you were a bad guy? What if you despised the West, or Hollywood, or apple pie, or Gerard Henderson, who is as apple pie as apple pie? How could you use these forces to advance your ideological or evil ends? And it hit me. We were fast reaching a crossroad where malefactors would no longer need networks or money to achieve their dastardly goals. They could simply free ride on what technology and globalization were making available for free. Well, not strictly for free, but if you're smart and bad, you can make any technology free simply by stealing it. Back then, I imagined a time when a single person sitting anywhere, even on a beach or in a car park, could wreak havoc on a global scale, so long as they had the right tools or codes at their fingertips, plus phone signal. And think about this horror. The only thing protecting the free world would be that lousy signal from Vodafone. But the truth is, we have already reached that crossroad. Fact: this week, Spanish police arrested a Dutch citizen alleged to have launched the biggest cyber attack in history, and from where? His camper van. Fact: last month, the global CEO of energy giant BP, British Petroleum, Bob Dudley, revealed that BP receives 50,000 cyber attacks a day. That's a big number. Here are some more numbers. Bankers are good at giving numbers, that's all they give you. I've taken them from reports on cybersecurity issued by Symantec, the software security firm that many of us know, Verizon, a US equivalent of Telstra, and Ponemon, a US research institute. And the numbers I'm going to give you are 2012 numbers, so they're quite recent. Let's start with email. We all get bombarded, but a stunning 69% of email traffic never actually makes it to you because it's rejected as spam beforehand. But of the 31% you do get, not all of it is clean because of clever techniques the bad guys use, such as phishing with a PH, not an F, which I'll explain soon. And it's not just big companies like BP that get attacked. 31% of attacks are aimed at businesses with under 250 employees. It takes a long time and a lot of money to deal with cyber attacks. On average, 24 days and a cost of $600,000. And with companies around the world seeing an average of 1.8 successful cyber attacks a week, firms are spending up big, in one case shelling out $46 million last year to respond to cybercrime. Attacks using the web increased 30% in 2012, many of them from waterhole or drive-by activity. That is, where you innocently visit a malicious website and infect your computer with a payload. Symantec says that in 2012, they blocked 74,000 malicious websites. Every day, critical vulnerabilities in the key software you use are discovered. In 2012, around 100 were discovered every week, or 5,291. But how many were not found? No one knows. The most costly cybercrimes are caused by denial of service, web-based attacks, and malicious insiders. Now, Prime Minister Julia Gillard knows a lot about denial of service, web-based attacks and malicious insiders, but she recently confirmed that in 2012, the Australian government suffered 438 cyber attacks so serious they required a response by the Cyber Security Operations Centre. She also reported that 5.4 million Australians were victims of cybercrime last year, with an estimated cost to the economy of $1.65 billion dollars. So maybe that's where the government's fabled surplus went. But here's the thing. We, the good guys, aren't helping ourselves. Studies in 2012 show some shocking figures. Only 49% of companies have bothered to install cyber detection technology. If that doesn't worry you, and it should, this will. Only 51% of companies insist that the laptops, tablets and other mobile devices that their employees use are configured with security settings and controls. A massive 40% of companies don't require security settings at all, and 9% simply don't have a clue either way. On top of that, a whopping 60% of firms shrug their shoulders, saying their employees circumvent or disengage whatever security features they've been asked to put in anyway. One study found that 12,000 laptops are lost weekly in US airports. And if that isn't bad enough, more than half held confidential corporate information, and more than two-thirds of the people losing them had done nothing to protect it. So some of us in business seem pretty dumb. But this is an asymmetric war, and the crooks are getting smarter as we stay dumb. Let me introduce you to one of their favourite tools. 29% of all targeted attacks and a whopping 95% of state-affiliated, i.e. espionage attacks, use what's called socially engineered phishing, with a PH. What the hell is it? Well, it's where the bad guys identify their target, search corporate websites, Facebook, Twitter, news reports, to find useful information about you. Then they make up a spoof email to you from a trusted insider, so it says it comes from someone it's not coming from, and then they send it to you. A common phishing expedition just a couple of weeks ago was, "Hey John, watch this video of the Boston bombings. The bad guys are smart and they're quick. You may have clicked on one of those yourself and infected your computer. Maybe you should check." 2 years ago, cyber fishermen hooked a monster catch. Irony of ironies, it was a sophisticated cybersecurity firm called RSA, and its client, the largest US defence contractor, Lockheed Martin. RSA makes these tiny secure ID two-factor authentication tokens that lots of us use to generate random passwords as an extra security measure. A spoofed email from a recruiting firm popped up in RSA's HR department with the header, 2011 recruitment plan. And the message, "I forward this file to you for review, please open and view it." The attached Excel file was embedded with a malicious flash object that when opened would create a backdoor into their system behind their firewalls. Fact, a few weeks later, RSA recalled 40 million of its security tokens because, well, they weren't secure anymore. Not long after that, RSA's client Lockheed Martin announced it had been hacked, although it claims it stopped the attack in its tracks. You'd hope so, given what they do. What's especially fascinating about socially engineered phishing is that the biggest dummies in companies, the people who click most readily on these phony emails, are higher-level executives and managers, people who love spreadsheets and love reading PowerPoint, people who have greater privileges to access, people who are basically really rich targets for hackers. Verizon claims a cyber campaign of merely 3 spoof emails has a 60% chance of success. At 20 emails, Verizon gives them 100% probability. The RSA email I mentioned was sent to one person and CC'd to 3 others. What odds would Tommy Waterhouse give them? A hacker who advised me on The Trusted says he targets his phishing so well, his success rate is 3 clicks out of 4 emails. Not only are the bad guys going phishing, there is now a thriving black market in what's called crimeware, weaponized exploits or code that bad guys sell to each other to exploit vulnerabilities in software or websites. They're sold on what's called the underweb or the deepnet, a kind of eBay for terrorists. One package apparently rents for $10,000 a month, though I scratch my head wondering who the bad guys use to do their credit checks or their money clearing. Facing all of this, the statistics, plus anecdotal evidence from questions I've asked numerous people in corporate Australia, suggests that in many Australian businesses, we are operating with our eyes closed, with one arm tied behind our backs, and the other crossing its fingers. Part of it is a rosy view that it's not real life, that it's stuff of movies and novels like mine. Part is a belief that we have on our that what we have on our systems isn't that important, or even if it is, that we're also frantic paddling to stay above water, that we don't have time or money for the upscaling in costs or resources. To all of that I say, it's not if, it's when. And if you think what you have isn't important, why do you bother locking your doors when you go home at night? Plus, the evidence is that most of us have no idea what might be going on under our very noses right now. While most data exfiltration, or theft, takes only a few hours, if not minutes or seconds, in an astonishing 66% of cases, the victims take months or years to discover it. Partly, that's because we're not even looking. A big problem, I think, is that too few of us are thinking like bad guys. This dawned on me during my research for The Trusted. When I started conceiving my terrorist gambits, I decided I needed some experts to help me, to check if the attacks that I was imagining could really be done. See, I learned from my first two novels that readers love to tell you if you've made even a tiny technical or factual error. Gerard, please note. In the first edition of Nowhere Man, my first book, I mentioned the Davis Cup Grand Final, and a reader phoned me, from France, I might add, and said, there isn't a grand final in the Davis Cup, just a final. Or in what I thought was the final draft of Born to Run, there's a gruesome scene when the first woman to win the White House, yes, it's fiction, is attacked by wolves in the wild. I'd also mentioned grizzly bears. But luckily, in that case, I'd taken the precaution of sending a draft to PJ O'Rourke, the US political writer and satirist. And while he loved the book and gave me a great cover quote for it, he warned me that the only grizzlies in that part of America were politicians, so I had to change them. So for The Trusted, because it relies so much technical stuff, I went hunting for experts. I found them in the US, Australia, Asia, the UK, Europe and Scandinavia. And they're from many fields. Hackers and IT specialists, nuclear engineers, naval architects, banking and finance experts, a steel production expert, algorithmic traders or algos, geneticists, smart grid gurus, even an Antarctic expert, and I see one of my experts in the room today, but I won't point him out. But with most of the experts, I found a certain rhythm repeating itself. I'd start out with, look, my bad guys want to do X. How can they do that? And at first the experts always answered, they can't. On probing why not, it was mostly because my initial idea was so lame and so obvious that the good guys had already nipped it in the bud. Good. So I'd go away and I'd think some more. Like a bad guy, then I'd return and ask, well, what if they did Y, not X? How would that work? And this process of what if and no because often went back and forth several times for days, in a couple of cases, months. But in almost every case, there was that aha moment when my expert would say, heck, or perhaps something a little stronger, yes, the bad guys could do that, and then they'd explain how. But if it wasn't for me, a proxy for a bad guy, pressing and pushing them, the specific tricks might never have occurred to them because, like most of us, they think like good people. Now, before you panic about what I reveal in the book, let me say that while almost all my bad guys' stratagems are possible, the book, for ethical reasons, is very hazy on the mechanics. Now let's look at how close in real life we are to the picture I'm painting in the book. As I run through this, I'm inviting you to observe that if we've got this far in fact, worse is not far away. In The Trusted, I point out a huge vulnerability in our financial markets that I believe is ripe for the bad guys to exploit. It's algorithmic or high-frequency trading. This is where super powerful computers run by programs, not people, scan multiple markets and news reports simultaneously, trawling for the briefest, tiniest trading opportunity, aiming to be the first to execute orders into the market, often in milliseconds. If you put HFT, high frequency trading, and cybercrime together, the potential for instant, and I mean instant, economic catastrophe is mind-blowing. You don't have to read The Trusted to learn this, though I hope you do. So guess what? Last week, the bad guys had their first relatively successful attempt at exploiting this. Fact, on April 24, the Syrian Electronic Army triggered a trading frenzy that in 3 minutes drove the Dow down by 149 points, wiping $140 billion, around 1%, off the market's value. How? By hacking into the Twitter account of a trusted news agency, Associated Press, and falsely tweeting that two explosions in the White House had injured President Obama. Now, true, the plunge didn't last long, because AP immediately corrected the story and the market bounced back. But without HFT and algorithmic trading, the panic wouldn't have been as bad or as quick. How did they get the password for that account? Phishing, probably. But maybe a trusted insider gave it to them instead. Far-fetched, you think? Well, no. Fact. Only last month, Reuters fired a man called Matthew Keyes, its deputy social media editor, who police charged the next day with giving the infamous hacking group Anonymous the computer network logins for his prior employer, the Tribune Company, the owner of the LA Times, the Chicago Tribune, and the Baltimore Sun. As one of my bad guys in The Trusted says, why bother occupying Wall Street when you can destroy it from the inside? Say next time it's not a tweet. Say instead that one of the sophisticated algos working on the HFT code is a bad guy. My experts say it would be easy to implant code to generate a trading pattern that tricked other market players into thinking a downturn was coming and thus trigger a market meltdown. Yet stock exchanges naively sell access to their trading infrastructure to these people without a clue what their secret algorithms do or are capable of. They take it largely on trust. These exchanges to me are like railroads hauling a company's products, but uncaring that what could be inside the unlabeled drums is radioactive, because they don't think like bad people. US President Ronald Reagan once said, trust but verify. So which exchanges are verifying? And even if some are, frankly, are they smart enough to know what to look for? Now, some other vulnerabilities out there. What about cloud computing? The trend du jour. Cisco predicts that by 2015, one-third of global data traffic will have shifted from premises-based computing to cloud-based computing. Outsourcing your data and systems onto someone else's network is economically hugely attractive. Many of us are doing it almost unthinkingly. How many of us here are on Gmail, for example? But clouds carry some very big risks. First, they make you a target even if you weren't one before. If you're sharing a cloud with government departments or giant multinationals, that cloud is suddenly a very, very juicy target for the bad guys, and you're in it. Worse, the cloud is effectively a single point of failure for the hundreds or thousands of firms and people using it. Denial of service or volumetric attacks that overwhelm a network's infrastructure with bandwidth-consuming traffic or resource-sapping requests is likely as a major form of attack. It's happened already. Deny service to a cloud and you deny service to everybody in it. Last year, the firewalls of several cloud providers failed during denial of service attacks. But crack a cloud open and voila, you have bad guy heaven, what is already called hyperjacking. And may I say that these days, if it has a name, it will happen. More vulnerabilities. How many of you today or yesterday saw a software update pop up on your computer screen from Apple, Microsoft or Adobe, and you simply clicked accept? Everybody? How did you know it was real? Even if it was real, how can Apple, Microsoft and Adobe be so positive that nowhere in their sprawling organisations is there a single individual intent on planting some malicious code or bug or vulnerability into that update? With these weaponised exploits now being sold on the black market for huge dollars, suddenly the financial incentives exist where they didn't exist before. As I said at the beginning, what if your computer blew itself up? Well, the bad guys have got close, and here are two examples. Fact, last April, 41,600 Apple Mac users in Australia and 600,000 of them worldwide woke up to learn their Macs were infected. And the trigger? Yes, a simple click accepting a fake Adobe update. Fact, last August, the bad guys got even smarter. Their aim, in this case, was to cripple both the Saudi Arabian economy and global energy production. And they managed to implant what's called the Shamoon worm, which is apparently Arabic for Simon, into the national energy giant Saudi Aramco's computers. While Shamoon didn't succeed in shutting off supplies, it did wipe 30,000 computers clean. Yes, clean. And caused the company to close down its internal networks for 10 days. Each time the bad guys try something, they share the information. They sell it to each other and they get smarter. Yet half of us good guys aren't even using detection technology, the basics. Here are some more real-life examples out of my opening tonight. How do you shut down a city's power plants? Well, increasingly, power plants are operated by what are called sophisticated SCADA systems, S-C-A-D-A, or Supervisory Control and Data Acquisition Systems. In lay terms, SCADA are internet-facing, remotely accessible computer control systems used to monitor and control pipelines, energy and water utilities, traffic systems, airports, and all of that. But we think we're safe, don't we, that the companies running these systems are competent, as are the bureaucrats regulating them. Well, I hope that's the case in Australia, but it's not what Finland found when in January this year, researchers from Aalto University went looking and they discovered 2,915 unsecured, completely exposed, internet-facing SCADA systems in their country. Those systems were running critical industrial automation, power management, transport and water supply systems, remote access systems, including building automation for a bank, for a hospital, and if that's not bad enough, a jail. So now all a well-heeled mafia boss serving life needs to do for his get-out-of-jail card is hire a hacker. But back to energy supplies and the US. In January, the Department of Homeland Security reported that in the first 6 months of 2012, cyber criminals stole data that could disrupt or damage 23 gas pipeline networks across America. Fact, in September, Chinese hackers hit a Canadian group, Telvent, that specialises in SCADA systems and stole project files for a control system used in North America's electrical grid, its oil and gas pipeline systems, and some water system networks. So if you can imagine it, or I can imagine it, they can probably do it. In other words, as I've been saying, we need to start thinking like bad guys so we can stay ahead of them. Or to make me sound a little more scholarly, I'll use the words of the great Chinese military strategist Sun Tzu, to know your enemy, you must become your enemy. But to do that successfully, you do have to know who your enemy is. So let's find out who they are. Most people only look through one lens, one that focuses on their motivations. Through this lens, there are three main types of bad guys, and none will surprise you. Criminals chasing money, 75% of all attacks today. Spies, usually state actors chasing data or trade secrets, and hacktivists who want to advance an ideology or have fun. But that lens is only half the pair of glasses. Unless we look through the second lens, we might find we're not just fighting the last war, but we're fighting a medieval war. Recall, in medieval Europe, the kings built great fortresses with massive walls, towering battlements and huge moats, all to keep the invading hordes at bay. But where was the king's most powerful, most insidious enemy? Often sitting right beside him, inside the castle, eating the same food, drinking the same wine, often out of the same chalice. His wife, perhaps, his brother, his cousin, his consigliere. In other words, someone trusted and deep inside. So the second lens of the glasses forces us to look not only at the bad guy's motivations, but where they are compared to us. There are three places to look. Our partners, people who have some level of trust or privilege. Insiders, trusted people with very privileged access. And outsiders, where there's no trust implicit at all. Attacks from our business partners, you might be interested to know, according to Verizon, are low at 1%, whereas outsider attacks are 92%. Now, I'll come to insiders shortly. It's unsurprising that 92% of attacks are from the outside simply because there are so many of them and more they're using scalable technologies. So, unfortunately, we do have to build those modern-day medieval fortresses to keep them out, even though the evidence is most of us aren't even doing that. Currently, we can split up that 92% of outsiders into three first lens types as follows. 55% of the outsiders are criminals, mostly from the US or Eastern Europe. 21% of them are spies. 96% of those 21% Verizon claims are from China, which China vehemently denies. And surprisingly, only 2% are hacktivists. The balance is unknown at this time. Now let's explore the data on insiders, the trusted, the people I named my novel after. Insiders, of course, are highly privileged. They know where our crown jewels are. They also know where our weak spots are. Indeed, they may have even put them there. Attacks from malicious insiders are already substantial, and they are on the rise, and not just in Canberra. In 2012, insider attacks accounted for 1 in 7 of all cyber attacks, up from 1 in 25 just a year earlier. According to Verizon, most of these insider breaches are deliberate and malicious and arise from financial motives, often employees who have been or are about to be fired. A lot are through negligence or clumsiness, using an infected USB stick or sending a confidential email to the wrong person. But a Ponemon study says a remarkable 38% of firms by number experience attacks from malicious insiders. In other words, you have a more than 1 in 3 chance that someone in your organisation, someone you trust, will turn bad on you. In small companies, they're likely to be cashiers and frontline people, skimming credit cards and that sort of thing. But in big companies, they're much more likely to be executives, managers, and even systems administrators, people with privileges and access, high levels of trust, people with bigger desires. They can also be people low in the pecking order but who have high access, like help desk employees. Fact, just last week in Sydney, federal police arrested Matthew Flannery, a support technician at a cyber security firm called Content Security, for allegedly defacing a government client's website. Flannery also apparently claimed to be the leader of the international hacker movement Lulzik, though one of my hacker buddies disputes that. Earlier, I told you that the average time to resolve a cyber attack is 21 days. But if it comes from a malicious insider, it's more than twice that, 57 days. Why? Precisely because insiders know where and how to hide. Now, while I knew from the start that my bad guys would be insiders and what they do, cyber catastrophe, I didn't know what would be their motivation. In the golden olden days of thriller writing, the John le Carrés naturally drifted to people fighting the big battle of the 20th century, socialism versus free markets. But that is yesterday's war, though I wish someone would tell Wayne Swan. I pondered others. I pondered Islamists intent on destroying the West, but I felt that was too predictable, already a little cliched, at least in fiction. Then it hit me, the environment. The greatest moral challenge of our time, as a former, perhaps a future Prime Minister, has said. With so many of us worried about the planet, about clean air and water, it had to be inevitable, in my view, that a few, and my story only needed a few, would be extremists, people so disgusted by global inaction that they would sacrifice everything, their jobs, their reputations, even their lives. But that's what zealots do, even smart ones. My bad guy's mission wouldn't be a political ideology in the classic sense, nor status or money. Their sole driver would be to save the planet. How? By turning today's brilliant technology against itself and against us by cyber war. Ridiculous, you're thinking, right? Well, do you remember the Unabomber? Fact, as big a zealot as any, Ted Gaczynski, the Unabomber, was a Harvard graduate, got his PhD at 21, and became a maths professor at Berkeley. Still thinking ridiculous? Fact, when I first started exploring this notion, I found the FBI's top 10 most wanted list of domestic terrorists at the time included several radical environmentalists. But their radical environmentalists weren't my kind of radical environmentalists. Theirs were neo-Luddites, who slap on balaclavas and run around at night torching factories, whose most likely cyber activity was playing Mario Kart on their PlayStation. I wanted really smart people, people who look like us. People like the infamous Cambridge Five, Kim Philby, Guy Burgess and those guys, who in the Cold War did just that and infiltrated the highest echelons of the British Secret Service for decades without anyone knowing. People who Descartes, the 17th century philosopher, called evil geniuses. as he said, quote, people as clever and deceitful as they are powerful, and who direct their entire effort to mislead us, unquote. And I found those people in some very influential organisations, in some very influential positions. Sure, I made mine up, but fiction or fact, sometimes they merge. My message tonight is that if business doesn't even start looking or putting checks in place, we won't know till it's far too late. Thank you for being so generous.
Many thanks to John M. Green, and so we come to questions and discussion. Before we start, I remind people that Janet Grundy's got copies of John's three novels outside, including the latest, The Trusted, which forms the sort of basis of tonight's talk. And so we come to questions and discussion. So can I start off and say, why do it in fiction? Why don't write a non-fiction account of the kind that you've done tonight?
People love stories, and stories are one of the most effective ways to explain to people the issues that are facing them. When I started writing this book, I wrote it primarily as an entertainment, an escape. That's what a good thriller is supposed to be. But I also wrote it with the intention of it being a red flag, so that when people read it, they might think about their own situations. And I felt that the audience for this type of thing would be bigger as a thriller than if I'd written it as a non-fiction book.
Just stay here, yeah. Right on the back. You just stay here, yeah.
John, I'm picking up that...
No, just say, we're doing a podcast today, so if I think we can't hear you, I'll repeat it. So, okay.
I'm picking up that the systems are probably okay, but the people using them are not using them properly. So isn't a systems problem, it's a people problem.
The question is it a systems problem or a people problem? I think it's both. Firstly, it is firstly a people problem. So more than half of us are not using any detection or prevention software. We don't know what's going on under our own noses. But then we rely on systems that we buy. We don't update them, and they're being updated almost daily. The systems are easily flawed, and the task that the people supplying them have is immense. As somebody once said, you know, it's an asymmetric war. We have to get it right all the time. The bad guys only have to get it right once, and they can break in. And these weaponized exploits, these vulnerabilities which they're finding, because now there is a black market in them, the chances of people who are designing these systems actually creating the vulnerabilities is higher than it ever was. And if not that, the chances of them being blackmailed is also high.
So we go right down the back and we come to Craig. Yep.
John, just my question. I thought you were going to write it, so you could so aligned with what you were talking about, but the Whitehaven folks were an environmentalist using ANZ fake media release and wiped it out 8%. Your observations on that in terms of who the losers were, because clearly there were people trading in that time frame, and what should be done about it?
Question about the Whitehaven hoax and who the losers were.
Look, the Whitehaven hoax clearly is relevant, and it's similar to the AP tweet I spoke about the other day. It was related to one company. I guess why I chose the AP case was because it impacted an entire market, and it was so fast and so easy. Now, yes, it's easy to send out a fake email, a fake press release, as they did in that case, and people are affected all over the place. Now, in the case of the AP hoax, if you were a normal trader sitting back scratching your head, it would have taken you more than 3 minutes to do anything. But if you're an HFT fund out there, you're trading millions of times in that 3 minutes. So the impact is enormous.
Craig.
Chris. John, what is known about the spoils of cybercrime? I mean, there's vexatious cybercrime, but for those who are seriously interested in laying their hands on money, what is known about the extent of that?
Not a lot. But the money is immense. So the attack on the Apple Macs that I mentioned earlier, the 600,000 Apple Macs, the payload that was loaded in did a couple of things. One was it stole some of your personal information, which they would then use to go and raid your bank accounts and so on and so forth. It also led your computer to lots of websites that used pay-per-click advertising. And so these guys were making a fortune out of the pay-per-click falsely and getting paid for it.
Craig,
John, in your research, is there anything you can add to the whole China China effect within the cyber terrorism world? Because they get fingered a lot for so much. Is there anything you can enlighten us on?
I should be inscrutable in talking about China. But I'll say one thing. I was sitting in a dinner a year and a bit ago next to one of Australia's most senior government ministers. At least he was then. And I mentioned to him that in a couple of months' time, I was going to China on a board visit. He turned to me. He grabbed my hand. He looked at me very intensely. And he said, under no circumstances take your phone, your computer, your tablet, or any electronic device. That is the message that all of government has given itself, and that is the message that they've been giving to business. So they ought to know more than me, and that's what they think.
Can I just add to that? The advice that's normally given by, for example, Control Risks is don't take your iPhone or your iPad, but you can certainly take a BlackBerry because its protection systems are far greater. But on the China thing, they are accounting for something like 92% of all attacks. Mm. But there was one day last year when that level just completely dropped away, and that was the
National Day.
It
was a public holiday in China, and the attacks dropped by about
20%. So we go down there and we come over here. Yeah. You've written three novels now, and you've outlined tonight some of the ways in which you researched the trusted. Do you use the same research methodology in all of your novels? Do you have a certain method in researching them, or do you do it differently for each novel?
I guess I'm learning as I go that the first novel I wrote, Nowhere Man, is a financial thriller, and it was about something I knew a lot about, having been... I was then a recently retired investment banker. But I did have to do quite a bit of research in that, in any case, and found experts again, and read lots of stuff, both books and non-books. In Born to Run, which was a political thriller about the United States, I am quite a United States politics tragic. And so I had lots of books already, I had lots of information, but I also had lots of friends who knew stuff that was very relevant to this, and I tested a lot of that with them. So, for example, as I mentioned earlier, I sent a draft to PJ O'Rourke, who writes about US politics all the time, and he gave me some comments in addition to the ones which I mentioned earlier, as did some other people. I found a glitch in the United States Constitution for that book, which was one of the hooks in that book. And I'd written half of the book when my wife, who's sitting over there, said to me, John, you haven't been a lawyer for about 15 years, and you were never a constitutional lawyer, and you weren't even a US constitutional lawyer. So what makes you think that you can write a book that has a hook with a glitch in the US Constitution? So I, of course, ignored her for a while and kept writing. And then she mentioned it to me again a few months later, and I thought, maybe I should humour her. So through some contacts, I found the general counsel for the Senate Constitutional Law Committee in the United States. I gave him my thesis on a page and said, this is what I think is a problem in the United States Constitution. Am I right? Almost immediately, I got an email back from him with an article attached that merely said, yes, see my footnote 14. And I was right. So I proudly showed my wife that I was right and that here I am, a US constitutional lawyer.
Right down the back, yes.
John, I want you to imagine that you're sitting on a risk committee of a board or a statutory body. What does your board do to change behaviours of directors in the context of this new world and how they go about discharging their duty?
I think the key thing, actually, right now, is awareness. Most of us don't talk about this. When a subject of IT security comes up at a board, most people's eyes glaze over, and the sort of reports you get are quite superficial, and all of these sorts of things. I'm chairman of a risk committee, and I recall some time ago, the head of risk turned up with the risk management strategy for the next few years, and it was very good. And it had lots of checks and balances in it, as you would hope it would. And so I, having already written most of the book, said, so tell me, do you have a super user password? A super user password is basically a master key to every system in the organisation. And he said, of course, I have to. And I said, well, why should I trust you? Even the United States president can't press the nuclear button on his own. You need a check and a balance. So I think that, you know, we do trust people more than we should. As Ronald Reagan said, as I mentioned in my address, trust but verify. We don't verify enough. And I think we need to be talking about this a lot more. It's not alarmism. It's just common sense.
So I think we're getting towards
if you don't trust anyone, life becomes intolerable. If you can't trust your wife, if you can't trust your kids, your fellow directors or whatever, where does it stop? And it just destroys the fabric of society.
That's why I used Reagan's words, because he says, do trust, but verify. So we just don't do the verifying. That's the problem. You know, we have to trust in life. Civil society can't work without trust. But, you know, you've been in negotiations, Fred, many times where you say something and the other guy says, well, don't you trust me? And what's your answer?
Never mind. Depends which firm you work
for. Anybody who says trust me can't be trusted.
Yes?
Mike, I'm the chairman of a risk committee too, by the way. We use an internal audit, obviously, and they purport to report on the efficacy of our internal systems. How do I verify that?
Just repeat the question,
maybe. The question is, if you have internal audit verifying your internal systems, or it's telling you that the systems are okay, how do you verify that? Increasingly, people are asking outsiders to come in and check, and do a double check.
Do a double check.
Yeah.
Do you check them?
Well, you know.
It's like mirrors down the...
But the thing is, a lot of the people in your organisations are under enormous pressure to do things on a very cost-effective basis. And they don't feel that they have the resources necessarily to do what needs to be done in this case.
Yeah, go for quick. Yep.
Yes, I just wonder how aware people at the top are that people in the middle might actually hate them and hope their organisation fails. I mean, I've seen that in all sorts of things, like in a school situation. I've recently talked to a fairly high member of the Labor Party. He hates the Labor Party a hell of a lot more than he hates the Liberals. And I don't know what he does about it, but this hatred of people who are your boss, especially if you haven't got up or you think you are better or you can't be bothered going up. How do you do it then?
Disgruntled employees are a major risk in any organisation and they are a fertile ground in this area. The FBI released a circular last year about insiders and the risk of terror from insiders. It was, in my opinion, naive and stupid. It focused only on two sorts of people. Disgruntled people, who are obvious, so I think it's right to be worried about them, but it was only focused on them, and on profiling people who might be Muslims. So it said the sort of questions you should have your... the sort of statements you should have your antenna up for are people who are unhappy with their work, right, tick. Or people who perhaps take long unexplained absences for religious purposes. And say, well, okay, we know what that means. But nowhere do they say, what about people like Descartes' evil geniuses who are there for ideological reasons and who aren't disgruntled? They make it very clear that they're not going to be disgruntled. They're going to be your best employees. You know, when I was at Macquarie Bank in the late 90s, one of my most trusted colleagues was jailed for insider trading. In the business that I was in at the time, that was the most heinous offence that someone in the advisory business could be in. But he was probably the most trusted person in the bank. And we all said, how is that possible? How could that happen? And that was a watershed moment for me in terms of looking at other people.
Final question. You've done three novels. What's next?
Thank you. My next, well, this book, The Trusted, is the first of a series. So I've introduced a character called Tori Swift. Tori is a 28-year-old Sydney-born surfer-turned-spy who was a child prodigy. She's a PhD in nuclear engineering, and she spent the last 6 years in the CIA but was just kicked out. And she is embroiled in this conspiracy with this group called the Nine Sisters, who are these evil people who are trying to save the planet by destroying it. So the next book I'm writing, which I've already started, is Tori's next adventure, where she encounters quite an unusual pope.
This sounds a bit like what Barry Humphries used to call a trilogy in eight parts. Look, that's been a great night tonight. Janet Grundy's got copies of 1, 2, and 3 novels, and we've got 4 to 37 on order. But tonight, 1, 2, and 3. But congratulations, John. It was a terrific night. I learned a lot about matters I didn't expect to learn about. And I think we all did tonight. Well, those of us who didn't know things learned a lot, and those of us who knew things were able to challenge matters. And it's been quite a compelling talk. Very interesting discussion period. It'll be up on our podcast in perpetuity. And Anne will publish the paper in the Sydney Papers online in due course. And no doubt we'll have you back again. But thanks tonight for a good story, compellingly told, and well done. Thank you. Thank you.
You have been listening to the Sydney Institute podcast. This podcast is proudly brought to you through the support of Microsoft Australia. We hope you enjoyed listening and can join us again soon.